Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors, and sometimes, like today, we're going to be showcasing a best-selling author, and he'll be on with us shortly. I am your host, Tom Riddell. Today's show is show number 109, and the date is February 21st, 2022. A brief intro to today's show. Robert Dugani will be here to talk to us about his writing life and the world played chess. Can't wait for that. He'll be on in about 15 minutes. Now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell. In the blog section, and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for the Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. Special note, we can now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike. And I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on The Writer's Lounge on March 7th, 2022, Jay Sapini wrote Wapsipivinakan Summer, a small river town. Townspeople deals with the Vietnam War and how it impacts the lives of its citizens in the 1960s and beyond. And after that, on March 21st, Claude Fouchard will return to the Writer's Lounge after 10 years with his Vigilante series. And we'll hear more from Claude then. That'll be exciting. I hope you'll tune in to these exciting upcoming shows. And now in the second part of our program, we go on to writers' topics. And much of the topic of today's broadcast will center around, of course, Robert Dugani's book, The World Played Chess, which highlights stories of Vietnam and the impact that it had on people back home. While this book is of fiction, the war, of course, is real, and the people were real who fought over there. So many of us will never, ever know what it's like to fight in a war zone, and will never experience the horror of watching our friends and even our enemies die right before our eyes. In today's audio clip, we'll hear from a man who fought in Vietnam, and we'll listen as he describes his first day of combat. His name is Rick Hazen. He served in the U.S. Army 4th Infantry Division from 1968 to 1970. This is a little over 3 minutes, and it's called The Dancing Man. After this, we will be back to introduce Robert Dugani to the Writer's Lounge.
Working for the Federal Forest Service, 1967, out of Mapleton, Oregon. Girlfriend, planning on marriage. Going to be a regular human being. Get married, have a family, build a house, and retire. Get a gold watch. 1968, got a draft notice. Got on the plane, I believe it was in Fort Lewis. Landed in the Cameron Bay, got off the plane, got onto these buses. The windows had expanded metal over them, and I thought that was odd. It was more like getting on a prison bus. But news to me, the expanded metal was over the windows to keep the grenades out, not to keep us in. They took us out to a field, and they pointed to different groups of where we were supposed to go. And I was assigned to Delta Company, 3rd of the 12th, 4th Infantry Division. Fella told me and pointed in the direction. And I walked over to a bunker, and there was about 7 or 8 guys standing there. And I walked up and said, "Hi, my name's Rick. I'm supposed to be here." And Sergeant said, "Here." And he handed me a box of 200 rounds of M60 machine gun ammo and a belt of 200 rounds of M60 machine gun ammo. Said, "These are yours." And then he handed me a mortar. And he said, you'll carry these everywhere you go." And my journey began. We climbed on a chopper, a helicopter, a hilltop with trees taken off and bunkers around it. And from there, we started walking. We spent probably 6 hours walking. And a sergeant said, "We're setting up here." Next morning, we got ready to move out. We had eaten breakfast, and a couple of the cans had been thrown out from our depression out in the undergrowth. Off of the trail came these people, these soldiers, Viet Cong, approaching us from the trail. They were ducking into the tree line, and they, unbeknownst to them, they were headed straight for us. They kept walking and walking, and we all crunched down, and with our M16s and our M60 machine gun, a lieutenant in the Chinese Army walked up and saw a discarded peach can laying on the ground. And when he looked up, he was hit with probably 6 M16s and an M60 machine gun, and he danced. I carried that image of the dancing man for a long time.
Okay, that was, again, Rick Hazen. God bless him for his service to our country. And now let's get on to the main event, which is guest author Robert Dugani wrote The World Played Chess. And if you'd like to call us in here, don't be shy. You can give us a call at area code 914-219-0868. Of course, that's if you are listening live to the broadcast right now after 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the book, The World Played Chess, here is my partial review of The World Played Chess. Vincent Bianco, a recent high school graduate, finds a summer job working as a laborer on a construction crew. 1979 brought with it raw and horror-filled stories and memories of the Vietnam War and many of the wounds of veterans who served were still festering and causing much emotional pain and suffering. Vincent worked with and developed a very close relationship with one of two of his coworkers who served in Vietnam. William shared some of his stories with Vincent, but much more was revealed about his time in Vietnam via a diary which William gave to Vincent to read. The stories within would change Vincent's life, and 40 years later, much of the lessons learned within that diary would impact his relationship with his own son as he heads off to college. Robert Dugani has an ability to tell a story in a very unique and interesting way, and his style has captured me, as he did when I read Sam Hill, another novel of his. This novel teaches us about war, but more importantly, it teaches us about our humanity and how we move forward while not forgetting the heroes and the atrocities that we leave behind. William's diary is riveting, and I could feel how those stories shaped Vincent's mind. It reminded me of how important it is to acknowledge our veterans and to always help them in whatever way we can so that they can find meaning and purpose in their lives. We owe it to them. This novel is a must-read for anyone who wants to learn and maybe to understand what happened over there in Vietnam. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Robert Dugani to the Writer's Lounge broadcast as we now push the old magic button to open up the doors to the Writer's Lounge. And I'll do that right now, and hopefully Robert is there. Robert, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Nice to hear your voice, sir. I loved your books, and it's a pleasure always to talk to somebody like you. And where are you calling from tonight?
I'm calling from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, so you're all the way over on the other end of the states here. I'm in New York,
and you're
in Seattle. Yeah, how's the weather there?
I am, yeah. You know, surprisingly, it's clear today. You never can tell. This morning or last night, you looked and it was supposed to snow today, of all things. And it's sunny and clear blue skies. So it's good. It's nice.
Great. As I said, it's always wonderful to have such an accomplished author on our show, such as yourself. Your books are in the hands of millions of readers. Tell us, Robert, how did this writing career start for you?
Well, it's a long story, Tom. Basically I wanted to write since the seventh grade. It was always a passion of mine. My mother was an English teacher before she started having 10 kids, and I was a troublemaker in school, and they decided between them, my teachers and her, that what I needed was something to keep me busy, that I was bored, and so she started handing me books, and I started reading books like The Great Gatsby and The Count of Monte Cristo and The Old Man and the Sea and Of Mice and Men and all the classics. And I didn't know what I was reading. I just fell in love with the stories. I fell in love with the characters. I fell in love with, the ability that you were reading about almost like somebody's life on a page. And, from that moment forward, it's what I always wanted to do. It's what I wanted to be. I took a detour, practiced law for about 13 years. I mean, that was basically an act of fear. I was afraid of, what happens if the writing career doesn't pan out. And, my parents were big into all of us getting as much education as possible. So I went the legal route, but I never lost the desire. And I finally, after about 13 years, I just reached that point where, I woke up one day and realized I wasn't getting any younger. And I didn't want to look back on my life and say I never gave myself the chance. So with a very loving and understanding wife, we took a shot. We took a chance. And, she stood beside me and in front of me. And here we are. There's been a lot of ups and downs on the road. But as I tell writers when I speak to them, you just got to keep putting one foot in front of the next. And you just keep going forward.
Very good. 10 kids. Wow.
Yeah. And I'm smack dab in the middle of them. So I'm a classic middle child. My wife will tell you that anyway.
Any of your brothers or sisters also take up the pen to the page?
No, none of them. I'm the black sheep. They all became doctors. They're all doctors. There's a lawyer. There's a CPA. They're all more science and number oriented. But, you know, what I like to say is that I was the one who wrote their college essay application to get them into school. So, okay. That was a part of it. But, no. And they don't really have the desire or the ability to write. But, they're talented. My brother Bill is a surgeon, and he started painting some years ago, and he's really, really good. So, you know, there's some artistic genes somewhere in the gene pool of the Degonis, I'll tell you.
And the World Play Chess is selling very well. I just took a look at some of the reviews, and you're soaring up there with the number of reviews. That's amazing. It's a coming-of-age story revolving around stories of Vietnam told by the character William, who was a veteran of that war. There's a line in your book that tugged at my emotions, and this is what that said, and this is quote, "Maybe that's why William had thrown out his medals. They didn't mean anything to him because they didn't mean anything to the world that passed him by. Certainly nothing positive. Vietnam was the war everyone wanted to forget. So did he, apparently," end quote. So I grew up during that time, so I can relate to what William's feeling. Do you think America still wants to forget, and do you think stories like The World Played Chess can help to bridge that gap in understanding?
You know, I think war in any aspect is a difficult topic. What's going on in the Ukraine right now,
yes,
I think is a topic that Americans would just as rather not have to deal with. We're going through a difficult time in our history with the whole COVID problem, and you know, there just seems to be one problem after the next, and then on top of this you have an authoritarian government over in Russia that, you know, looks to be beaten to a different drum. What happened in Afghan, I think a lot of those poor soldiers were forgotten over there. And when we finally made the decision to get the heck out of there, we really kind of botched that. So, whatever your political views are, and I'm not political, I just think that war is a very difficult topic. And Vietnam was the first war that we, you know, quote unquote, lost. We didn't come home to parades and people kissing in the streets and shouting out of cars or anything like that. You know, those soldiers came home, people that were protesting them and spitting on them and yelling at them. Those soldiers, they didn't want to come home and talk about it. They didn't want to come home and talk about their experiences. And that's something that I dealt with even as I was writing the book. It's not something that they want to discuss. But because of people like Oliver Stone and people that have written novels, which I relied on heavily, they got the story out. The movies Platoon and Deer Hunter and Full Metal Jacket and all the other ones that are out there. The story eventually came out, and I think people have become more empathetic to what happened over there. They lost sight of the fact that these were 19, 20, 21-year-old young men that were being told to run through a brick wall, and they were trained to do it. They were trained to go over there and kill. And so that's a really difficult thing to have to deal with. And I think for that reason, many Americans, they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want it to be part of the American story. And, even today, we'll see. The reception to the book has been very good because it's a book about Vietnam, but really it's a book about growing up. It's a book about, men, boys becoming men where there's no owner's manual. Nobody tells you how to be a good father, or how to be a good husband, or what that means necessarily. We either emulate the people that raised us, or we tend to learn on the job training, which was something that was said to me often when I was working on that construction crew. I get up there and do that. Well, I don't know how to do that. Well, you'll learn on the job training. Go. And that's, you know, for some people that's a job, and for some people that's a war.
Yeah, it seems there's a different dynamic today in regards to war, the ones we have fought since Vietnam, where the troops that return home aren't treated as horribly as they were in the 60s. It seems like maybe we've learned something there. We're more patriotic, even though war is never something that I think we should cherish or, get excited about. It certainly isn't that. But you had just mentioned something also about, in regards to writing this book, you had mentioned that you worked on a crew just as the characters in your story work. So did this story come out of that relationship with the people that you work with?
It did. The impetus for the story definitely came out of that relationship. You know, I had written The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell, and the book had done, continues to do extremely well. And so they had, you know, they had told me when that book was published, they said, we'll see you in the next 3 years. That was my literary publisher. And what she meant was it takes about 3 years to get the next literary novel done. It just takes longer than when you're writing genre fiction, which I also write, you know, police procedurals. And so, I had been thinking, okay, well, what am I going to write about next? And, you know, I have a bunch of ideas floating through my head, but what usually happens it just becomes really a simple story. And for me, suddenly that summer of my senior year in high school, I began to realize the profound impact that it had on me and how it really did alter my life. It changed the course of my life. You know, like a lot of people out there, and men or women, you know, we sometimes are raised in the cradle of great homes, good homes, good parents, you know, good brothers and sisters, small towns, you know, very little crime, and we come out of there, you know, a little naive, which is not a bad thing. I strove very hard to make my kids naive as much as possible when they were growing up, so that they could just have a childhood that they enjoyed. I figured the world would come soon enough. And that's really what this book is about. It's that moment when the world comes knocking on a young person's door and they answer it and they realize that they are really unprepared for what awaits them out there. And I think, you know, that's the difficult thing for a lot of us, whether we go off to the workforce or whether we go off to college or in this instance, whether these young men, mostly young men, went off to war. So, you know, it's really that moment in my life that I thought, wow, you know what? I wonder if there is a story here. So a lot of it is based upon actual events, things that happened. A lot of it is based upon moments that I did spend, and the guys would start talking to me a little bit about what happened. One of the foremen on the job, I ended up working for him for over 3 years, you know, at summers and breaks. And so, you know, I just pushed everything kind of into one summer. And the other thing is, you know, writers write what's inside of us. You know, the book is of me. So the journal is certainly fictional. The characters are real, but the journal is fictional. It's a made up. Because I never really knew what the character, William, I never really knew what, I take that back. I did know he was a Marine photographer, and I did know he took photographs, and I did know those photographs never made it home. I knew that much of the story behind it. But the actual day-to-day existence over in Vietnam, I didn't know. And for that, I relied upon firsthand accounts. I relied upon the men who actually fought. And had to deal with it on a daily basis.
Right. When you sit down to tell a story such as this, do you ever think about much about what your readers would like you to write about, or do you just let the stories out of your head, trusting that your readers will like it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it would be naive to say that no author out there doesn't think about whether the readers will like his work or her work or not. I just don't think that's honest. I mean, obviously, you want to write a book that is popular, that people talk about, that they enjoy, that gets good ratings. you know, all those things. There's a pride element involved. There's an ego involved. But at the same time, you have to be honest, and you can't, at least I don't change my stories. I want them to be raw and unfiltered and honest, because I feel that if they are, then the reader will respect that. They may not necessarily like the book. They may not be somebody that likes to pick up that type of book, but they'll at least appreciate the fact that the characters are real and honest and unfiltered, and the story is unfiltered, that it's not a story that I put together to try to make a movie out of or try to make money off of. It's just a story that was told to me. I know how that sounds, and I don't say it lightly, but a lot of writing is listening to the story that's being told and then transcribing that story that's being told honestly.
Right, right. There's another line in your book that I want to bring up here that I think that will resonate with many veterans, and it also adds conflict and a lot of thought to your story. This is what you wrote, quote, "You don't make friends," Williams Corporal Victor Cruz had told him, "because someday you might be putting that friend in a body bag. So selfish, so stupid," unquote. So I'm sure you talk to veterans of that war, as you had mentioned. Do you think that holds true with most veterans, that they would feel the same way?
Yeah, I don't know how it is today. I do know a gentleman that I golf with, and he is a vascular surgeon, and he served over in Iraq, and he has a lot of positive memories that come out of it. I think what you have is you have that these young men find themselves in an extremely difficult situation. Some of them have leaving home for the first time. They don't have parents there anymore. They don't have brothers and sisters. They don't have the friends that they had when they were growing up. And so there's a certain they all sort of gravitate to one another because they're all in the same circumstance and they're all facing the same pressures and tensions and all those things. So there's an existence there that they tend to gravitate to. Is that a friendship? I'm sure there were friendships that were made in Vietnam, and I'm sure there are friendships that are made today that continue by people that are veterans. But that really struck me as something that was both told to me and then read in one of the sources that it was difficult to make friends because you always knew in the back of your mind there was the possibility that person you were so close to would not be there the next day.
Right. Right. And us humans are natural in developing a friendship or a relationship, especially with somebody who is next to you fighting for their lives. And so I found that very interesting, coming from a psychological kind of interest in your story and how veterans deal with those kind of things. And that's just another layer of the horror that they have to go through over there. And I just found that that really brought it out for me in your story to realize that these were people that you wanted to be friends with, but sometimes you just try to keep that at a distance. And that must have been awful hard, and it must be awful hard for any human being to do that with somebody that they're actually in close proximity to, especially in the time of war like that. I found that very interesting. Let's talk about your other books, the many other books you have written. What was your favorite book to write and your favorite character?
Oh, that's a hard one. I guess I'll answer it this way. Seattle Police Detective Tracy Crosswhite really put me on the map. Before I wrote My Sister's Grave, very few people knew my name. I had another series out that had done okay, but not great. And Tracy really is what exploded and put me on the scene and got millions of readers to gravitate toward my novels. So that character always will have a special place for me. Sam Hell in The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell.
Yes.
Because it certainly wasn't autobiographical in any way, but it was something that was very close to my own childhood.
Yes.
Growing up in a house that was filled with the school that I went to, the teachers that I had, the irony that was sort of involved in that. So it was a story that was very personal to me, and for that reason, I think it will always remain up there in that top two, you know, positions.
Right, you're talking about Sam Hill, right?
Yes, the extraordinary life of Sam Hill.
Tell us a little bit more about Sam and how did this story come about? Can you go a little bit deeper into it?
Sure. So, you know, I had time some years back to finally read Stephen King's book On Writing, which had been given to me as a Christmas present. And I read it, and it talked about what is the magic of writing. You know, what's the great secret to a great story, which was obviously incredibly interesting to me because, you know, please give me that information. Stephen King said it's telepathy. And I was sort of kind of disappointed because that's clearly not one of my skills. And then, you know, as I sat to kind of think about what he really meant and what he said, and what he meant was that how does an author sitting at his desk in Seattle, Washington, touch the heart and soul of a person he's never met and never will, living in a small town or city that he's never visited and never will? Is telepathy. A little bit later, I was up in Surrey, British Columbia, and I was on a writing panel with Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series. And somebody from the audience at the end of the session asked if Diana would discuss the magic. And really, without missing a beat, she talked about the magic of writing being that she goes into her office late at night and she lights a candle and she waits until her characters feel comfortable to start to talk to her. And when they do, she writes down what they're saying. And again, that intrigued me because it was similar to what I had, you know, read in the King book. So I decided to give it a try. And of course, you know, nothing happened and nothing happened and nothing happened. And, you know, right about the time you're about ready to say, okay, this is all a bunch of hooey, this kid started talking to me and started telling me, you know, the story about growing up in Burlingame, California, and an only child. And so I started to get sort of the outline for the story, but it was coming at me so quickly that I literally would have to get to my desk and write as fast as I could. And I had two screens, and on the second screen, I would just write in next chapter, next chapter, next chapter with a small blurb what the next chapter would be. So a lot of different things came about. I was one Sunday morning reading the paper, and there was a small article in there about a young Australian boy that was denied admittance to the Catholic school because he had red eyes. He had ocular albinism. And I went, oh, my Lord, there it is. And I had already named my character Sam Hell because that was something that my dad used to say to my five brothers and I all the time. What the Sam Hell are you doing? You know, why the Sam Hell would you do that?
Yeah.
And so it was almost eerie the way things sort of fell together. And that was my character. And I had him, and I wanted a character that understood what was going on. I have a brother who's severely handicapped. He has Down syndrome. And, you know, I love my brother to death. My brother doesn't understand. I think my brother understands he's different, but certainly not to the extent that Sam Hell would understand. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a character that understood that he was being treated differently. He was being bullied. He was being discriminated against simply because of, you know, how he looked and what he did. And so it was perfect. It was just the right thing for me. You know, I just stayed with the story for many years, and I'm glad that I did.
Yeah, it's interesting talking about character development. I've never heard that before. It's even got a kind of a paranormal kind of twist to it. To light a candle and listen for your characters start talking. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, Tom. There's a movie out there, and I think it's called The Man Who Invented Christmas or The Man Who Saved Christmas. There's two of them out there, and I'm talking about the one that is about Charles Dickens when he wrote Scrooge, when he wrote A Christmas Carol. And if you watch that movie, which I happened to do on an airplane flight. You know, it's not a great movie, but for me it was incredibly intuitive because it was exactly what I had just, you know, Diana Gabaldon had told me and et cetera, is, you know, how did he write that story? And basically what ends up happening is Scrooge comes into his office in the attic of his house and starts to talk to him, tell him, and then other characters start to show up. And, you know, these are characters that have been a part of his life. You know, the two men on the street who say, well, don't we have prisons? Can't we put, you know, can't we put poor people in the prisons or whatever? You know, all those characters come back. And I think that's what writing is really about is understanding that when people come into our lives, there's probably some reason for it. And allowing that to, you know, allowing them to come back and to, it, you know, even with me, when I wrote The World Played Chess, you know, I could see the two guys that I worked with vividly, and I could hear them again, and I could remember the garage and sitting on the 5-gallon white bucket while, you know, they would tell me about some of the things that happened to them in Vietnam and why I didn't know shit and, you know, excuse my language and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they're very real to me. I could see them. I could see them talking to me. So
yeah, that's,
I think that's
very
as a writer.
It's very strong and very powerful when that happens. It brings a smile to my face because it's when the story takes off, when that connection is made. And I like your description of sitting around on the white buckets. I can see that in my mind. It's very good. What's your day like as a writer? Where do you go to write? Do you write in private or do you sometimes prefer a public place?
Mostly I write in private. You're very lucky. My wife and I, we added on to our house and we put in a big room in the back of the house, and it's my office. And I have these massive windows and I can look out at bird feeders that I put up and I can see the birds coming to eat. And, you know, I try to exercise every day. And sometimes that's early in the morning. I got up today and I swam and then I was at my desk by 7. And, you know, I'm either working on a new story. I'm doing developmental edits with my editor on a story that I've already written, or I am working on a story, doing developmental edits and doing copy edits then on a third story, you know, because everything kind of happens in stages. You know, this morning I got up and I teach a seminar on writing. And so I was working on a couple of student papers. And then when I got that done, I had to go down to a local bookstore here in Kirkland, Washington, to sign my new book, The Silent Sisters, which will be out tomorrow, February 22nd.
Wow.
So I signed all those books for him. I came back and I'm outlining the first 100 pages that I've written for the next Tracy Crosswhite book. I do it a little bass backwards, if you will. I'm not an outliner, so I found that I'm just not good at outlining. So what I'll do is I'll write probably the first 100 or 120 pages. And now I feel like, okay, I know what the story is. I know where I'm going, but I want to be able to keep track of all the names and places. So I'll go back and I'll actually put together an Excel spreadsheet about each chapter, who's in it, what, you know, place they're in it, and blah, blah, blah. So I was doing that before I jumped on the phone here with you.
Wow, that's exciting. You're putting another baby out into the world. That's that's quite a thing. That's great. And I was just going to ask you.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it sure is. I was going to ask you about outlining your stories. You prefer not to, which is interesting too, because the majority of the authors that have been on this program, and what is it, you're the 109th show that we've done. Most, I would say, probably 85-90% of the authors that I've talked to over the course of the last 10 years have said that they don't use outlines. That it's more of a free-flowing type of thing that happens when they sit down to write. Do you ever use any kind of editing software? I use editing software, and the name escapes me right now, but it's the Pro Writing software is very good, I think. But do you use any of that?
I don't. I don't. And you know, over the years, people have said to me, "Do you use this? Do you use that? It helps. You can put." As you're writing your manuscript, you can put pictures in so you can see what it looked like and you can describe it. And, you know, you can do this, you can do that. And, you know, I think Tom, I'm 60 years old. I grew up with no computers, you know, and I didn't have a personal computer until, I don't know, well into my legal career. And so I didn't sort of grow up with, you know, that whole era. And I have found that the amount of time that it would take me to learn the program, I can do just as well with my own little format, which is what I sort of described to you. I think a lot of authors, at least from, I'll talk for myself, but your percentages don't surprise me, because I think of a lot of authors, when you're writing a novel, you're not writing an essay, you're not writing a thesis statement and topic sentences and all that kind of stuff, but, which is very formulaic. Writing novels is formulaic. I mean, that's the truth of it. The structure of a novel is formulaic. Joseph Campbell talks about it in The Hero's Journey, then in The Writer's Journey, the name of the author will come to me. He sort of modernized it. And if you look at it, we have been telling stories the same way for thousands of years. And so I understand story structure very well. I studied it. I, you know, got kicked in the teeth a number of times by, you know, when my stories didn't follow story structure, and then I couldn't write my way out of the corner and that, you know, all those things. But over the years of studying it, I understand story structure fairly innately. And so what that allows me to do then is to be more open and free-flowing with respect to the characters who I place in that structure. And, of course, the structure changes. It's not always the same. But I think the creativity of a good story comes in the characters in the setting, not necessarily in the topic. You know, they said that there are only 7 different types of stories, you know, and they're either this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, I often say, you know, to people, you know, how many of you have read or seen the movie Moby Dick? And then they'll say yes, and I'll say, well, it's a great story, wasn't it? I mean, there's great scenes, great characters, and they're going after, they're hunting this beast and blah, blah, blah. And then I'll say, how many of you saw the movie or read the book Jaws? And they all go, oh. You know, it's the same story. It's the exact same story. It's just different characters in a different setting, you know, and it's really the characters in the setting that are going to bring life to your story, because really the structure is just the place, almost like the place where they live. And so how is your character interesting? You know, the girl with the dragon tattoo is another great example. But why did they call it the girl with the dragon tattoo? Because she was the most interesting and unusual person in the book. So, you know, that's how I operate. I kind of have a hybrid type of way of doing it.
Yeah, I agree. The characters have to be your cream of the crop. It's got to be the character, otherwise you lose interest. I was watching a movie the other day with a friend where all these people got into an elevator, and it was basically the whole movie took place inside of an elevator with these 6 or 7 people. And it wasn't the setting. It wasn't the setting that was interesting. It was the characters' lives that were interesting and held you to the movie. Because when I first started looking at it, I thought, how am I going to get through 2 hours of watching people in an elevator? Well, what you're talking about is exactly what it is that it's the characters that you're reading that makes the story interesting. Not so much the setting. The setting can add to it, but it's the characters' lives that you really, really want to know more about. I could go on to talk to you more about where do you do your teaching at?
It's a seminar. It's the novelwritingintensive.com is where writers can find it. And I teach with Stephen James. So we teach in Jonesville, Tennessee, or this year we're teaching out here in Seattle, Washington. So it's usually in one of those two places. We do it once a year. We limit it to 12 students, and we take 50 pages that they are working on, and The seminar is both teaching classes on writing and then critiquing the manuscript and using the student manuscripts to emphasize and bring out the different things that we're trying to teach the students. And it's really a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. And every year I do it, I'm like, oh, my God, this is a lot of work. But it's incredibly rewarding. Meet some really wonderful people from all over the world, really. We get students from France and you name it. You know, that's what life's about. Life is about meeting people and spending time with people. And you never know who's going to come into your life and what impact they're going to have on your life. And that's really what a story is, right? A story is someone coming in into somebody's life and what's the impact of that person on that life. So to me, it's really very rewarding.
Right. If I'm a student learning from you and I sit down with you and I start talking about writing a book, what are your thoughts on whether new authors should self-publish or go the traditional route?
Well, I think the first thing I tell authors is understand story structure. Go get Christopher Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey, and understand what it is that writers do. And primarily what we do is we entertain. And if you're not entertaining the reader, it doesn't matter whether you go traditional publishing or self-publishing or whatever, you're not going to get picked up, you're not going to get an agent, you're not going to get an editor, or even worse, you're not going to get any readers. So, you know, I really think that it depends on what it is you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, I think that if you can go the traditional route, if you pick up an agent and you pick up a big publishing house and you're going to go the traditional route, then terrific. But I think you also have to understand what the traditional publishing route is all about, and it's all about selling books. And you might not get the type of publicity and promotion and PR budget that you wish you could have, because there's a lot of other writers in that publishing house that they're trying to promote. I've been traditionally published. I got back the rights to some of my books from that traditional publisher. And those are self-published now. They're handled by my literary agent. And of course, I'm now with Amazon, which I think, you know, some people would not consider traditional publishing, but I do. It's you know, I have an editor, I have a developmental editor, I have a copy editor, I have a PR person. I mean, I have a whole team behind me who does my covers and my titles. And you know, I can't imagine not having them. I'm not a person that wants to get out there and, you know, do a bunch of promotion. I'm a guy that likes to write. I just want to sit down and write the next book. That's my joy in life. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in letting people do their jobs. And if someone is really good at promoting, and I mean, Amazon's just got some phenomenal people out there on who can do covers and titles, and I'm just really impressed. And so, you know, I want them to do their job because they're going to do it better than I can do it. So I think every writer has to ask themselves, what is it that they want? What is it that they're hoping to get? I taught a man one time who wrote just a beautiful novel, just a beautiful novel. And I said to him, you know, what do you want to do with this? And he said, well, I want to go the traditional route because I want to, you know, want to have a big company behind me. I want to have a big publisher behind me. I said, well, what did you do for a living? He said, I was a salesman. I said, what'd you sell? And he said, I sold auto parts all over the United States. And I said, were you good? He said, I was the best in my company for 35 years. And I said, so why do you want to turn over the promotion of your book to, you know, possibly a 30, 25-year-old, you know, guy or woman who's fresh out of college just learning their craft? So you've been doing this your whole life.
Right.
And he went, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. And he's done really well for himself. So, you know, I think you have to ask yourself, what are your skills? What do you like to do? What are you good at? Some people are really good at promoting, and some people aren't. So, you know, I think that's going to dictate, more than anything, I think that's going to dictate what people should do.
Right. If you could name one author who is your favorite or that you've learned from, who would that be?
Stephen King, without a doubt. And I'm not a horror guy, so I'm talking about, you know, The Green Mile. I sit down and I read The Green Mile every day that I'm writing. Every day that I'm writing, I sit down and I read passages from The Green Mile because it's so brilliantly crafted, and he is so amazingly good at using all of his senses in every page, on, you know, creating tension on every page. I mean, I think the guy's just a genius, and he's going to go down in the names of the legends of writing. So I study what he does, and I try to emulate it to a certain extent.
Also, one of my favorite movies is The Green Mile. I love that movie.
Terrific. Terrifically done, terrifically adapted. Really, really well done. And, you know, that's a testament to who King is, because just like J.K. Rowling, they were not going to go off track on any of the Harry Potter movies because they'd have, you know, 500 million fans ready to kill them. And, you know, that's how King is. You know, he's so popular that, you know, he when somebody buys his book, they're going to stick to the script.
Right, right. How do you deal with reviews, the good ones and the bad ones, now that you're a seasoned author?
Yeah, you know, I look at every review as a positive review, because it means that somebody has taken the time to read my book and have an opinion on it. I'm never going to have, you know, there's never going to be a consensus of opinion, but that's what life is all about. There's going to be people out there that don't like my books. But there are people out there that don't like some of the greatest literature that was ever written. You know, there are people out there that hate To Kill a Mockingbird and give it one star, you know. And so, you know, it is what it is. You're not going to please everybody. I really don't spend the time ruminating on the bad reviews taking to heart too much the great reviews. There are some that are just so heartwarming and so touching that, you know, people will email me directly. I got one today that was just incredibly touching about The World Played Chess, how much the book meant to her because she never understood why her brother was different when he came back from Vietnam. And after reading my novel, she now understands why he took his own life.
Wow.
You know, you can't not be human to get an email like that. And those are the things that I think keep all writers going, is the love of the craft, the love of the writing, and those beautiful emails and those beautiful reviews that we get that people say, you know, your art touched my heart.
Wow. Robert, what do you like to do when you're not sitting down there writing all these novels?
Well, I'm kind of a masochist, so I took up golf about,
okay.
about 2.5 years ago. But,
okay.
you know, I absolutely love it because I get outside, you know, 4 or 5 days a week. I'm walking, you know, 2, 3 to 6 miles, depending on how many holes I play. I'm with friends. I'm with, you know, people that I'm meeting. And I'm socializing. And it's just, you know, if you don't take yourself too seriously, and I don't. It's really just, it's a great hobby. It's a great pastime. I love to fish. I fish with friends, and I fish with my son. My son comes out and golfs with me. My daughter comes out and golfs. And so it's just great family time, great to spend time with them. I really love them. I enjoy their company. And, you know, you can get to know them on a different level. So so those are probably the two main things. I used to like to run, but I now have 2 artificial hips, so I'm told running is no longer part of the equation.
Right, right.
So I have a lot of fun.
You're in my age group. I'm 66, and you're 60. I have this image of you sitting down at a typewriter. Did you ever pound out a novel on an old typewriter?
I don't think it was I don't think I ever did a novel, because I didn't really start writing my novel, I think, until 1998. So I don't think I ever had the courage to type out but I did send letters, you know, when I was a lawyer. I remember the days where, you know, you would dictate into a dictaphone a letter, and your secretary would type it up, and she'd use carbon paper. And then if you had changes to make, she'd have to go in with the whiteout and all the other stuff.
Right.
But the beauty of it was it would get mailed out, and you wouldn't have to hear from the other side for like 3 days because, you know, snail mail took a while to get there and then come back. And you'd have a break. You know, now at the end of my legal career, you know, that was the hardest part, was it was just instantaneous. You know, You send a stink letter, they send a reply stink letter. You send them on, I mean, you could send out 20 in a day. But so no novels, but I do remember those days.
Oh, yes, the old whiteout. I could have probably 50 bottles sitting in front of me doing that with a waste paper basket next to my desk. Robert, we've getting near to the end of the show here. Now is your time to shine. I kind of like to think of this as your Oscar moment. Any parting words that you would like to share, or would you like to thank anyone out there?
You know, I always want to, you know, thank my family, my wife, kids who have stood by me through, you know, the good times and the bad. And, you know, my parting words of advice to people are whatever your passion is, you know, find your passion and find a way to make a living at it. Because when you get up every day and you're able to do your passion, it's true. You don't work a day in your life. And, you know, I just feel very blessed that I get to get up every day and come into my computer and write. It doesn't mean that they're always all good days, but they're always days where I'm doing something that I love to do. And that would be my wish for everybody, that, you know, find what you love to do and find a way to make a living at it.
Very good. Where can we contact you? You have a website that you want to direct people to, or where would you direct people to buy your books, especially this new one that's coming out? I'm excited for that.
Yeah, it comes out tomorrow. It's called The Silent Sisters. It's the third in the Charles Jenkins trilogy. So that's really kind of exciting. And I think it's the best in the trilogy, and some of the early reviews are saying the same thing. So you can find me at www.robertdegonibooks.com and robertdegoni/Amazon. I think it is my Amazon site where you can find everything you need to know about me. But those are the two best places.
Very good. Robert, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I've certainly learned a lot from talking to you, and absolutely hooked me on Sam Hell. That just took me on to your next book, and I'll be looking for some other material from you too, and I'll plan on reading it. So glad we had this connection, and thank you so much for being on the Writer's Lounge.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
There goes Robert Degoni, and that was very good interview. I love when that happens. Everything flows nicely. And with that, the final chapter tonight, final thoughts, in Monday on March 7th, 2022, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, we will have on Jay Sapini, and this isn't it wasn't planned this way, but it just happened so much that Wapsipinian Summer, I can't even pronounce that word, but it's another look at Vietnam, as small river town people deals with the Vietnam War and how it impacts the lives of its citizens in the 1960s and beyond. And until then, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep your pen and your eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
If they asked me, could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make